across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan
Show! Good morning. On the programme today, make smacking children illegal. That is the call from the Royal College of Paediatrics. Scotland and Wales have already changed their laws to make it illegal to hit children, but the UK government says current laws already prevent violence towards children. So should we ban smacking? Or should parents be trusted to know how to discipline their children? The Department of Health says any change in the law would require executive agreement. So what do our local political parties think? Also on the programme, just how valuable are university degrees these days as fees and other costs mount? Are they worth the money? And are they the best way into a well-paid career? Or are there better ways to get a job, like apprenticeships, for example? And another member of the AA contacts the Nolan Show after they couldn't get roadside assistance because they didn't have a valid MOT. The Stephen Nolan Show!
It is Thursday, the 18th of April. Hello, how are we all doing? It's Holly Hamilton here once again on The Nolan Show. I was slightly distracted once again at the top of the show there. I think the team behind the glass must have thought I was doing a little dance as we went on air. I lost my pen again, somewhere between sitting at my desk and going into the studio. It's okay. I've got it. Panic over. It was in my pocket. Not to worry. I'm quite old fashioned about things like that. I like a pen all the time. Whether I'm doing radio, TV, it doesn't matter. I always like a pen in my hand. I love a notebook and a pen. I don't like to rely on technology. Later in the programme, after 10 o'clock, we're going to be talking about the value of university fees. Sorry, not university fees, university degrees. The fees certainly comes into it. Are they worth the time and money? You know, or would you be better with another avenue into the workplace these days? I'd love to know your experiences of that. We're also going to be talking about the difficulties people are facing getting their MOTs here and the consequences of that. We're getting a response from roadside assistance companies, the RAC and the AA, after some people here had some issues because of their lack of MOT. But first this morning, the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health is calling for smacking to be made illegal in Northern Ireland and in England. Now, in Scotland and Wales, they've already changed their laws to make it illegal to hit children. So this report has warned that children suffer lasting mental and physical effects from being hit in the home. But the UK government says that current laws already prevent violence towards children. Should we ban smacking, or should parents be trusted to know when it is right to discipline their child? Well, the Department of Health says any change in the law would require executive agreement. The Alliance and the UP have told us that they are in favour of a ban. The DUP say they're not sure. They say we hold specific concerns regarding how any change in the law would impact upon certain fundamental freedoms and parental responsibility. Any reforms of this nature would demand robust scrutiny as well as widespread consultation. What do you think? 03030 80 55 55. Let's speak to Kula Yasuma, former NI Children's Commissioner and now interim CEO of Parenting Focus. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Holly. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Also on the line, we have commentator Angela Epstein. Good morning, Angela.
Good morning, Holly.
Kula, I'll start with you. Now, first of all, it's an uncomfortable conversation, this, because there are people who have very strong views either way. In your view, what is the situation legally for parents as things stand?
So the situation legally, in fact, is parents can't physically assault their children. But what they can do is if they, what we call hit, smack their children, and it doesn't leave a mark, they have a defence of reasonable chastisement. So the law says that for the purposes of discipline, they can hit their child as long as they don't leave a mark. So they have a defence to something called common assault. And Holly, this is very confusing for parents. So, but at the moment, you can smack your child if it's in discipline, as long as you don't leave a mark. And you have a defence of a reason, what in our law says reasonable chastisement.
It's been described as vague, the current law. And just when you say those words, that you can hit a child as long as it doesn't leave a mark. And obviously for every child, that's different, you know, just in terms of how they might mark, for example.
And that's the issue. And I am not looking to blame or damn parents who use this form of discipline. But what parents have been telling, and Parenting Focus will be issuing the big parenting survey today, and what parents are saying is we want support. Over 86% of parents say we want support. And one of the areas they want support on is what is effective child rearing, what is effective child discipline. And if we go to the evidence, as Parenting Focus always will, if we go to the evidence says smacking your child is not effective. The evidence tells us that it leads to poorer outcomes for children, including aggression, including antisocial behaviour, including depression and anxiety in childhood and then sometimes into adulthood. It also tells us that it's a risk factor for more serious abuse. So what sometimes, not always, and not even in the majority, but what sometimes starts a smacking may end up as serious physical child abuse and other forms of abuse. So we know that by banning this this form of discipline for children, and we know by looking at what 63 other countries around the world, including, as you say, Wales, Scotland, Republic of Ireland and Jersey, that what the emphasis then is on parenting support. It's on offering support to parents. Our courts and our prisons are not full of parents who have smacked their children. But what they have done, what the legislation has done, is ensure those parents have received the support so this situation doesn't escalate.
So, Angela, I think what we're trying to get across here, it's about protecting children, but also protecting the parents, because sometimes they're not quite sure what the message is. And certainly, you know, going back, it was that whole expression, spare the rod, spoil the child. Parents of a certain age were told that if they didn't smack their children, then they were bad parents. And now this generation is being told the opposite. So it really is about information and educating people.
Yeah, well, I think it's about those things, but ultimately it's also about common sense. When you have a child, what you hope the laws of nature will kick in, and you will want to show that child unconditional love and support, reprimand it when it is wrong, and obviously praise when he or she is right. I absolutely abhor smacking children, you know, for heads up. I think it is the wrong way to discipline. Often it can be a way of displacing frustration. If they have just thrown stuff all over a floor that you've cleaned, and you're tired and you're going to have to do it all over again, the inclination may be in some people to smack in order to displace the personal anger. It's not even about the discipline. So it's absolutely wrong. I think on that we are all agreed. However, in terms of how to stymie the problem and how to stop the problem, can the law do this? I don't believe that's the way forward. I think the problem is, first of all, it's impossible to police within the home. It's impossible, you know, we have to rely on parents to understand and know their children. And those parents who don't know their children or don't understand the immorality of smacking a child as a way of discipline, I'm not talking about a little tap or something, you know, like, but, you know, child reaches over and wants to take the cakes and it's about to, he or she's about to have the dinner and a slight tap on the fingers saying, just don't do that, please. You know, that's quite different from, you know, doing something quite harsh. So, you know, we need to be clear that the parents that smack and smack without any kind of control, that message needs to be telegraphed to them. We need to stigmatize it as much as anything else, because those that don't do it, it won't affect and they won't feel any worse for it. And those that do will feel that it's the wrong thing to do. So some kind of broad education campaign explaining all the things that have been said about how it can have long-term impact, it can lead to more serious issues, it can lead to the child behaving in a way that isn't acceptable. All those things need to be pumped out into the public arena. But in terms of, it's all very well saying, you know, the courts are full, but if you make something illegal and somebody is penalised for something, then there is a process, a judicial process, where that has to be assessed. So that can't be the right way. Ultimately, first and foremost, we have to empower parents. to be able to parent their children. But there are parents, as we know, hopefully in the minority, who don't just smack their kids. They will be doing drugs in front of them. They'll be doing all sorts of things that are a million miles away from good parenting. But it's in the privacy of the home. Mm. How do you assess that?
Well, that's it, Kula. Just to pick up on that, you know, it's almost, well, impossible to police. So therefore, what's the benefit of banning it whenever it should be really, what Angela's saying, we shouldn't smack our children whether or not the law says it's okay or not?
Well, I think, and I think Angela's intervention has been very helpful, particularly around the education campaign. But I think a lot of things happen in the home, and Angela's given us some examples of things that we absolutely need to have an intervention for. What parents are telling us is they need clarity, so that if they do feel that they're going to resort to this form of discipline, that they seek help. 71% in 2022, when the NSPCC asked, 71% of parents said they supported legal reform, and that figure rose a little bit higher when they said if that support was provided. We can't introduce this legislation without having good parenting and family support to support parents to parent their children in the way they want to. But just because it's in the home, a lot of child abuse is in the home. That doesn't mean we don't have legislation and protective measures to do it. And if we send in clear message about what is acceptable and what is not, and because of then parents are more likely to seek help, not worry about this vagueness, well, you have not done anything against the law. We also know that, like I said, judicial interventions are not happening. And we've got 63 examples, and examples closer to home in societies like ours, judicial interventions are not happening. What is happening is parents are receiving the support. So this has to come hand in glove with good parental support. And I really welcome what the DUP said, that there's a number of things that need to be put in place before we change the law. But I look forward to Parenting Focus getting involved in those conversations with the Assembly and with the public to change the law quickly, but make sure support measures are in place to make that happen.
The reaction from the public on this has been interesting and actually divided. BBC Newsline reporter Eve Rosato, she went out into Belfast and asked people there what they thought about physically punishing children. Let's have a listen.
It just sets an example and a precedence for younger people as they grow and develop.
I think it would be like the last resort and try everything else first, but it did me no harm.
I can understand both sides there, but if I was to take one side, that's the way I would think would be. That I think a ban in place would be fair.
The government can overstep, you know, sort of a family environment, but if it's protection, you know, and it has to be the law, then it is a government issue.
So interesting. So generally sort of supporting a ban as such, but then we are getting texts. I mean, Norman's been in touch. He says, it's a nanny state government telling people how to raise my children. My father would give me a smack if I have done something wrong and I smacked my children. We wouldn't have the antisocial behaviour we have now if parents were to smack their children.
I think there's a generational issue definitely at place here, because what once is a societal norm, it's very hard when you've been brought up that way to shift the perspective. It is absolutely wrong, and the law is already in place for this, that if you leave a mark on a child, and I appreciate, Holly, what you said, it can be arbitrary and variable, because some children mark more easily than others. Mm-hmm. You can hit a child really hard and it doesn't mark. That doesn't make the smacking wrong. But the difference is that, first of all, you have to change the views of a generation, and we accept that. And that it never did, the whole ethos of it never did me any harm. But I also think it's really important that we don't disempower parents from being able to do some kind of discipline, and absolutely not smacking. They shouldn't smack. But if a parent occasionally loses their rag, what happens? I mean, I'm not talking about doing something serious. The child mentions it in school. What does the teacher do? Do they call the police? We've had plenty of cases where teachers have missed right under their noses children who've been subject to appalling situations in the home, and they've seen them in the classroom.
Just to pick up on that, because then someone has texted in, I've lost the text now, but they were commenting that, yeah, there we go, children go into school and they can make a comment, essentially, and what obligation then the teacher has to follow up on that?
So there's another, so and this is a really good example. So a child goes into school and says, I got smacked last night, or a child says, I got hit last night because I walked my muddy boots over a clean floor or whatever. The teacher's going to think, is that physical chastisement within the law, or is that something I should be worried about?
Yeah, and this, how do they make that decision? Clarity.
This gives that clarity. And what I will say is the default is not going into child protection processes. We have referrals. We have family support systems that teachers can and educationalists can refer into to sit down with the parents and say, what is it we can do to support you? On our own website in Parenting Focus, we've got top tips for parents around disciplining their children and around helping children understand, the impact of certain behaviours that does not involve physical assault. So we need to be clear that we need to send clear messages. There are top tips out there. Like I said, you can find them on Parenting Focus's website. But also parents, like I said, are telling us from the Big Parenting Survey that they want more support. And this will be an avenue to achieve that. Can I just say about it, that it did not do me any harm argument? I remember this argument. I remember when seatbelts were mandatory. Not everyone who has a car accident that doesn't wear a seatbelt gets seriously injured, but enough do for us to have introduced a law that said that everyone had to wear a seatbelt, and that has protected people, including those who wouldn't have been injured. So this is the sort of measure we're talking about.
I do think there's also, in terms of setting a precedent, and this is not because I'm some woolly civil libertarian who thinks everything is sort of has to be progressive, but I do think that when you introduce legislation as opposed to direction in this situation, where does it stop? So I give my children chocolate every day, or I give my children sugary drinks, or whatever it is a parent does, which obviously flies in the face of giving them healthy foods. There may be a million reasons why they do
and
that.
Yeah.
There has to be some way that parents can maintain their autonomy.
That is what
of
people
course.
Are concerned about. You know, it's this idea of, this is how I raise my children, and it's up to me to decide that. A lot of people saying that.
And parents are the first line of we protect our children, we support our children to better outcomes through our parents. That's a well-known. What I would say, and sometimes you'll find this campaign around banning physical punishment of children called Equal Protection. And it's called Equal Protection for a reason. We are not allowed, even as a light smack, even when he walks across with his muddy boots on my clean floor, I am not allowed to lightly smack my husband. I am not allowed to lightly smack my cat, but I am allowed to lightly smack my child under the age of 18. How is that fair? How is that right? That adults can hit children, but they can't hit other adults. I am not for one minute suggesting I worked in domestic violence. I know how important the law is to protect victims of domestic violence. But how is it we can protect adults, but we cannot protect our children?
And the difference is that you're doing it, hopefully, in a controlled way. And I don't
advocate
another
analogy.
Hang on a second. So I am not here to give direction to my husband. You know, he's an adult. He's been brought up. Whereas I am here to, so I'm just playing the devil's advocate. The parents direct the child. So it's an entirely sort of irrelevant comparison with the greatest respect. I don't think the comparison works.
But does it work? Is that the kind of the education, the information that we're getting that, a tap or a smack or whatever you want to call it, that is the right way to discipline a child, that's how they will listen?
I think the analogy does work because it's not the best way to demonstrate to show children how to behave and the consequences of actions. There are a number, as I've said, you'll find them on our website in Parenting Focus. There are a number of other ways to discipline children, to show them. And the adult thing, if we had an adult with cognitive impairment, or we had an older relative with, you know, who was struggling, would we to show them that going too close to the fire is dangerous, would we lightly tap them? No, we wouldn't. Of course we wouldn't. Mm. It would be wrong. And why would it be right for children when then we know there are other more effective ways of demonstrating to them that it's wrong to get too close to the fire? Very few parents tell us that they smack in a controlled way.
We're getting a lot of people to interrupt you there, but who are also talking about their own experiences. So these aren't parents, these are the grown-up children now, and how they feel now reflecting on their experiences of being smacked. Someone's got in touch to say lessons have been learned about psychological damage behind child abuse. People should learn child psychology, limit time discipline. This is what people need to know. People tend to put discipline first.
But can we draw a line here? I mean, it was outlined very clearly at the beginning that the law is in place to call to account those who abuse their children. So if somebody is hitting a child with the kind of force, and I know we've talked about the mark being a way of reflecting that, but it's come to attention that a child is being hit and abused, the law is there to protect them. The grey area here is whether somebody feels that they are now no longer even able to, if a child is approaching an area of danger, say the open fire or whatever, hopefully you wouldn't have an open fire near a child, the visceral response is protection. So obviously some people smack out of anger, out of frustration, out of a need to discipline. And some people do it because actually it's a way to say to the child, I don't want you to do that again. Now, I'm not saying that's the right way to do it.
Yeah.
But what we're doing is we are saying to parents that somehow you don't have the welfare of your child at heart. And I understand the seatbelt analogy as well. But the fact is that parents, yeah, it's great. These kind of conversations on the radio, big programmes, are brilliant because you can hear all the views. It needs to be mainstream. Absolutely. We need to have conversations about the disadvantages. But please, we also need to give parents some kind of latitude to understand that it's the thin end of the wedge in terms of not being able to parent the children in a way that most responsible parents do.
It's just to touch on that, the idea of people who experience this as the child. Someone's got in touch, he says Neil's not his real name. I'm the youngest of three children, born in 1976. My two siblings were born in 69 and 70. Our mother ruled the house with a wooden spoon. My older siblings often tell me that they were battered when they were young and I got away lightly. It has really affected my siblings' relationship with our mum till this day, and one of my siblings still holds a grudge to this day. And it's funny that we are getting a lot of people who are saying similar things. And yet, so just on that kind of the era thing and the age group, that it's almost split. The people who were affected by this as a child, who feel quite strongly that this has affected them as an adult. And then other people who are the same era saying, you know, what I said earlier, spare the rod, spoil the child.
But you can't define a law based on how it affects people. You know, if some people don't mind being injured in a car because they've not got a seatbelt on, that doesn't mean that the seatbelt law is relevant. You've got to define the law. Law has to be defined based on good judgment, morality, and lots of other things that come into play.
I just want to take a few calls on this just before you respond, because they've been waiting a little while. Dave, good morning to you.
Morning, Holly.
Morning. So you feel strongly about not smacking a child?
Yeah, exactly. I don't think it's right at all. There's a right way and a wrong way to bring up a child. Your guest there was talking about a child going down open fire. There's no point smacking a child because they're as near as an open fire. They don't understand the consequences of putting their hand on a hot fire. Like, I have a one-year-old, and you don't smack the child for going to the fire. You get a nursery guard, put it up around the fire. There's your situation dealt with. They can't get near the fire. You know, we think that there, leaving physical marks on a child is completely wrong. Like, my mother, years ago, you'd have got a clip around the lug, yes, but not now. It's not in this era. Like, you can't... Well, I personally strongly believe that you should not raise your hand at a defenceless child who can't hit back.
Dave, thank you for your call. Let's speak to Brian in Belfast. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Holly.
You disagree?
Well, up to a point. You mentioned early on experience. When I was growing up, I got a clip of hair in a year, you know, where I've done something wrong, and I didn't do that again. You know, I was spoke to many a time doing things wrong, spoke loudly by my parents. But, I mean, I give you one. There's an example that was in the paper last week. 13, 14-year-olds went and went on a ransack in a particular park we have here beside me, wrecked everything. If I was out at that particular time of night, my parents would be out looking for me. But I knew they'd be in time in the house. So there's a lack of discipline from parents, obviously. But go back to what I said at the start, Holly. It done me no harm, and the young people I grew up with, it done them no harm. And I don't mean really being violent towards children by no means. But a clip, and I'm not saying one or two-year-old, three-year-olds. It's when you get to the stage when you're five, six, seven, and you start doing wee things, you're told not to do it. Don't do it. You get a wee clip behind the ear.
And do you feel it was effective?
It done me no harm, Holly. It done me no harm.
Brian, thank you very much for your call. Just so many calls on this. We just want to get through before we get to the news. Stephen, good morning to you, Mahara.
Oh, good morning, Holly. Thanks for having me on. My point's quite simple. Children need a smack, and that's what the modern society is crying out for. We've all been in supermarkets and seen the kids running wild and squeezing and shouting, and the mothers have no control over them.
Oh, Stephen, have we lost you? Say that again, sorry. Stephen. You just cut out there.
Oh, sorry there. Well, whenever I was small, when we were in a supermarket or something, you started to misbehave, you got these nerves. The Sunday nights are my children are mad, and they're shouting and squeezing, and the parents seem to have no control on them. Children need a smack, not a beating, but they need a wee smack now and again.
Cola, what do you make of that? You know, because that's a couple of calls we've had there, basically saying, you know, it'll do them no harm, and they need a smack to discipline them now and again.
I think we've established that's not the case. The evidence is very clear that smacking it doesn't work. And I find it really quite distressing to hear that children need a smack. They don't. We know they don't. If a child and a parent is struggling in a supermarket, violence, albeit, you know, what some people would describe as minor violence, I wouldn't, is not the answer. Parent needs support. There are, like I said, a lot of advice and information on different ways of disciplining your child that does not involve violence. And we have moved on. We know and more importantly, Holly, and I'm speaking to all parents, we know you have told us again and again that you don't want to be smacking your children, that over 70% support legal reform. We know that also that even across the political spectrum, there is broad support, a little bit neutrality, but broad support for legal reform. It's time to be effective in our parenting. It's time to support our parents to do the job that they want to do. And physical assault of their children is not the job that they want to do. And there are other more effective ways of doing it.
Just before we finish this, Angela, there's one more text that's come in just to address this. That this legislation, they feel, will deter parents from striking their child in public, if nothing else. You see it all the time. The parent hitting the child in shops, at parks, etc., when perceived to be behaving badly. They say striking a child is always wrong. It's always an act of violence. Do you think that's just what's going to happen here with this legislation, the idea that it'll just stop it happening in public?
It's quite possible it can drive it inside. I mean, either something is wrong or it's not. If somebody sees a parent striking a child in a way that they perceive to be some kind of assault, then I would hope that they would intervene, although I recognise people find it hard to do that. But yeah, I mean, look, we want to stigmatise the behaviour. We want to, and I absolutely agree with that. We want to stigmatise it. But I still think that equally, if a parent wants to stop a child doing something in the park that's potentially dangerous, and they pull them back or they give them a tap on their arm, they don't want people in public jumping on them and saying, you know, we're going to call the police. There is a balance to be struck. I think education, but it's very hard when you're at the point of sale, and that this is about anger management. It's about so many different things that motivate people to strike their children
There's an imbalance of power there. You're the adult, they're the child. You shouldn't be resorting to a violent act. But sometimes, in moderation, there are those that may feel it's okay within their realms of parenting to do so. And it's very hard for the law to make the call on that.
Yeah. Angela Epstein and Kula Yasuma, thank you for your time on this morning. Thank you so much for all your calls and texts on that one. Just a statement from the Department of Health on this. They say this is a cross-cutting issue which is relevant to a number of departments. Any decision to amend the legal position will require the agreement of the executive. The Department of Health continues to play an important role in supporting parents and carers, in particular to promote positive parenting behaviours. A range of family and parenting support services are already available. They do include investment in the Parentline NI service, the Family Support Online Directory of Services, and the network of 29 family support hubs. It's the Stephen Nolan Show with Holly Hamilton here this morning. Just before the news headlines, we were talking about making smacking illegal in Northern Ireland and England, as it is in Scotland and Wales. Getting a huge reaction to this morning. A lot of you getting in touch with your own experiences. Anonymous says, I could not get my daughter to go to school. She fell down and I held her hair. She told the teacher I pulled her hair, so I had to go in front of two teachers staring at me. She's concerned about the dangers of that, just the idea of where you draw the line. Grace says, I have never heard such nonsense. If a child is naughty, a wee smack is okay. I got smacked because I didn't listen. Brian says, I don't think it should be banned. It's used as a boundary to the count of three and then a tap. That there is a difference between that and losing your temper. And Joe says, I was born in the early 1960s and me and my brother went to school black and blue. My mum got bit too. Gosh, this seems to be a totally separate issue here. We were terrified to go home. Our life was a living hell. Let's take another call on this. Good morning to Kenny in Enniskillen. Good morning, Kenny.
You were on there about children being attacked. My father, my late father, and mother, there were 10 of us. And we got an odd smack, and many another one we should have got if they knew what we're up to. But a wee smack does nobody any harm. And whenever we were going to fight with her parents, we were told to be good or we'd get a smack whenever we come home. And if we were bad, the mother showed the white of the eyes. And we know to be good.
I'll ask you what I said earlier on. Do you think that was why then? Do you think it was the threat of getting a smack was what stopped you from misbehaving?
Yes, well, it was the fear of the smack. It's like the children, some children don't like the naughty step now.
Yeah.
But the wee smack, like, I don't mean take the head off him or turn around and bruise him, but just a wee slight slap on the backside.
It's funny you mentioned the naughty step there. So why not just, if they're just as, I suppose, equally as scared of having to sit on the naughty step, why not just do that then?
Well, you see, the naughty step wasn't there in our time. That's a new thing that was brought in. But it doesn't seem to work because the young ones nowadays, they rail the parents instead of the parents railing them.
Do you see that an awful lot? Is that sort of just something that you've seen day to day?
Well, I'm in the lorries there and I see it each day and whenever I go out at night, I see it. That the way the children rules the parents and that some parents is ashamed of their children, the way they carry on, never to take them out.
Huge range of views on this morning. Kenny, thank you very much for your call on that. Keep your calls coming in throughout the morning, 03030 80 55 55. I imagine a few of you might have something to say on our next topic because we've been talking about this quite a lot on the news and of course on this show about the problems trying to get an MOT appointment here. Now, back in March, Stephen spoke to Michael. Now, Michael was waiting for an MOT appointment, but he'd broken down and called the AA, only for this to happen.
My wife and I had a rather stressful appointment at Craigavon Early Hospital last Friday, the 1st of March. When we came out after a couple of hours at the car park, the car wouldn't start. But I'm in the AA, so we immediately rang the AA to inform me that my MOT had lapsed 2 days beforehand.
Right.
Therefore, I wasn't entitled to any help. Because they said, if you must be taxed and MOT'd for them to send out anybody to help you. Because I had no MOT, I got no help.
Well, it seems that he's not alone, Michael. This has happened to quite a few people, this idea that they have no MOT because they're waiting for their appointment. They have booked it, broken down on the side of the road. They've paid up their AA or RAC, whatever the roadside assistance is, paid their fees, and they've been told, sorry, we can't cover you because you haven't got your MOT. Damien got in touch with us as well about some trouble that he ran into with his out-of-date MOT when he tried to get roadside assistance. Good morning to you, Damien.
Good morning, Holly.
So tell me, what happened to you?
Quite a similar story, really. It was just before the big storm last week, and I'd gone shopping sort of on the Friday instead of the Saturday to avoid the forthcoming bad weather. On the way home, the car had stalled, and then it just died. I was nearly home, but I was stuck with shopping in the car, stuff to get to the freezer, all the rest of it. So I thought, I'm in the AA, I'm covered. Give them a call, and basically I got the same response. I complained about it. I'm saying that because of the situation here with the hold up the MOT and whatnot, as I understood it, that as long as the car was roadworthy and had been serviced, an MOT had been booked and we were insured, we were still covered. But the response I got was a standard rote thing is, you don't meet the criteria, so you're not covered, period, and that was it. I did a bit of searching and found that they had posted, certainly on the website a couple of years ago, that they had said that if those criteria were met, you were covered. But we've had there was no indication from the AA any time in the meantime that situation had changed. And certainly the situation as far as the MOTs here haven't changed. If anything, they've got worse, so we're sort of stuck.
I suppose this is so frustrating. I know you've been a member of the AA for over 20 years and you had no reason to believe that there would be an issue. And it kind of defeats the purpose of it, really, doesn't it? It's meant to be the safety net for when you break down.
It does, and especially at the moment where they're saying the delay could be up to 2 months at least. And you couldn't, everyone who is a member who is in that situation could effectively be paying for 20% of the year when they're not actually covered at all.
And have you had difficulties then trying to get an appointment whenever your MOT ran out?
Yes, when I first booked it, it was due in February. I think it was in next month was the first one I got, May.
Oh, so hang on, you were trying to get it in from February and you couldn't get one until May?
Yes, 3 months.
3 months, because on the website it says the average at the minute is 72 days. That's even longer.
It was long. Like, I've checked, the same thing happened last year, but I was lucky last year. What they recommended was you periodically check for cancellation because they do happen.
Uh-huh.
And last year I was fine. I got in, like, it was still over, but it was like several weeks. It wasn't months. But this time, every time I've checked, there's been a non-available. So, not much I can do.
Have you faced any other issues around this? You know, things like renewing your insurance, anything like that?
No, because I think the thing that they recommended when I checked was that always check with your insurer, first of all.
Uh-huh.
And as long as they seem to be much more forgiving, for want of a better phrase, in that they say as long as your car is roadworthy and you're covered until the MOT is done, as long as you've booked one, they're happy as long as you've had the car serviced regularly and all the rest of it. So, yeah.
So there does seem to be quite a bit of confusion about this. And as I mentioned at the start, this is something that we have covered on this show before, and we had approached the AA, and their response does seem to have changed since then. They've said, we have listened to our members in Northern Ireland, and whilst the roadworthiness and safety of our members' car is paramount, we do accept that the MOT backlog is creating unforeseen problems. As a result, we will provide roadside service for members in Northern Ireland who can show that they are waiting for their booked MOT appointment and their vehicle is in a roadworthy and safe condition. We will continue with this process until the backlog situation is sorted, and they apologise for any inconvenience. Does that help you out?
Not at the moment.
You're not stranded at the side of the road outside Kirkcaldy anymore.
No, because, and again, so like my point is that because we did travel quite a bit from England to visit family,
uh-huh.
so we had like roadside recovery and all relay the full works as far as coverage went. So what they offered me at the time was we could send out and relay you home from where you are, but obviously they charged me for it. So I thought, on principle, said no thanks, and I contacted the local recovery firm to just get me the 3 miles I had to go to get to the garage.
Oh, so hang on, so they've already charged you for this then?
No, they said they would recover me, but I'd have to pay for it.
Oh, so you just said no thanks, but no thanks.
On top of what I'd already paid.
Do you mind me asking how much they were going to charge you?
They didn't say.
Didn't say.
No.
So that was initially, I think that was the response, that they would you'd have to kind of pay it and then you could claim it back. But now I think they've gone a step further and said, no, they will make allowances for people due to this MOT backlog. Damien, this isn't the first issue that you've had with getting your MOT. As I say, this has been happening for a number of years now.
It's not been too bad, really, apart from the last couple of years. Like during COVID, I think they'd stretched it a bit where there was they did the 2 year thing, which helped. It doesn't help as well that the fact that, you know, when you get your reminder out saying your MOT is due on, and it's like it's sent out a month before. So with the backlog we've got, even with that month, you're usually still looking at least a couple of months before you're likely to get it at the moment.
Well, thank you for letting us know, Damien. Hopefully this is helping somebody else out with any roadside assistant issues they might have with the MOT. Certainly doesn't solve the problem of getting an MOT appointment, though. And I did speak to UUP MLA John Stewart, who's the spokesperson for infrastructure. I began by asking him if he had been aware of this particular problem.
I absolutely am. I sympathise entirely with Damien and with the several constituents who contacted me recently who've been in a very similar predicament. It's stressful enough breaking down and the frustration that goes with that. And then when you prepare yourself, have your car in good order and you have invested in roadside assistance, when that happens and then it's turned down because of the reality that people can't get an MOT, it's very frustrating and very stressful, and sadly it's happening more and more often. So yes, very aware of it. I've actually contacted the AA, as I believe your show has too, Holly. They've come back to me to say they are aware of it and they are looking to seek a resolution. So there is some positive news, I hope, in that they are actually aware that Northern Ireland has this predicament, crisis if you will, in MOT provision at the minute, and as a result people who know through no fault of their own are unable to obtain an MOT.
That's and particularly with roadside assistance, it's not cheap, is it? You know, you're investing all this money in this to be told, no, sorry, you don't actually count. And it feels like we're going through this kind of box-ticking exercise just now with the MOT situation. So we're trying to sort of resolve every issue that arises from it. So this is just one example. It feels like roadside assistance is sort of just a symptom of a much bigger problem here, isn't it?
Well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah, it's one symptom. Another symptom is a constituent of mine who recently was clamped in Belfast because they had no vehicle tax in place because, like many of your listeners, their tax is aligned to their MOT date and they couldn't get MOT. The tax failed. It wasn't able to be renewed and they subsequently ended up getting clamped in Belfast and had to pay a £260 release fee. So that's another symptom of it. Now, as you say, there is progress, I really hope, underway. This has been raised several times in the chamber to the Minister for Infrastructure. I have met with him about it. We have raised questions. There was a debate in the chamber of the Assembly last month on this. And just this week in a question, the Minister said that he'd be making a statement to the House later this month on the mitigations and interventions that he'll be making to try and resolve this, because it's over 4 years now since we first heard about the crack in the lift way back in 2020. And rather than getting better, the waiting lists are measured in months, and just this morning I went on and there's nothing available again. And I think people have been very patient, Holly, but that patience has well and truly worn out.
What are they saying? What's the hold up? What is taking so long? As you say, it's 4 years and yet people try to get an appointment, and it's at least, I think, at least 2 months to try to get an appointment.
Absolutely. I'm told by the agency that it's, and they continually say it's a combination of things, that they're doing more MOTs than ever, over 100,000 a year. And to that end, I pay tribute to the staff who do the MOTs, who are incredibly helpful and full of assistance, do whatever they can on the day that you get your MOT, but it's actually accessing that. As you'll know, there was meant to be new MOT centres being opened, particularly at Highbank, that was supposed to be game-changing in terms of ending that waiting list. That has been delayed again, and we await an update on that from the Minister. So hopefully when that comes in, something will improve. But the reality is there hasn't really been any outside-the-box thinking in how this is resolved, and that's what I'm hoping to hear from the Minister later this month. As I say, Holly, people's patience has worn out on this, and they want to see action, and they want to see just this waiting list end. Now, just on the point I was making, I would say to people, if they do find themselves in a situation where, you know, they are waiting, they've got tax that's expired and MOT's expired, contact your local MLA or contact DVLA directly and ask for an emergency appointment. The rules were changed last month so that if your tax is about to expire, you can get an emergency MOT. They will try and prioritise you. So contact a local rep or contact the agency directly. My office gets dozens of calls every week on this issue.
I know, just that your office alone is getting dozens of calls. And so we've addressed the kind of the roadside assistance, which has been an issue. I mean, you're telling me that people are getting clamped and having to pay out fees for that. I mean, what happens if your insurance is running out? Are you still covered if you have no MOT?
So you would have to make your insurer aware, but at the minute, obviously, with the police have put a waiver in place that if your car is roadworthy and you're on the road while you've got an MOT booked, then you're okay. And that's a similar situation with the insurer, as I understand. But again, I would suggest to anyone in that situation to contact their insurer and make them aware of it. I do believe most of the insurers that are operating in Northern Ireland are well aware of the long ongoing problems we've had with MOTs here. But unfortunately, others like roadside assistance have technicalities and rules in place. And believe that's what the AA are currently reviewing, given the situation here in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. On the website, it says the PSNI has agreed not to penalise drivers whose MOT has expired as long as your vehicle is roadworthy and safe, properly insured, and you can prove that you have an appointment already to get it MOT'd. However, it does say that these arrangements only apply in Northern Ireland. So what happens if you enter the Republic? What happens if you get the boat over to England?
Exactly. And that is a question, and that's something that people really need to check out. But as far as my understanding, you'll have to have one in place, particularly if something went wrong or if you required roadside assistance, which you wouldn't be able to avail of.
So hang on. So if you haven't got your MOT certificate and you cross the border, you're not insured?
I'm not exactly aware of that. I think that will be down to each of the insurers. That when insurance is a different aspect than police enforcement.
Yeah, that's true. I'm not quite sure what way it covers it. Just on the actual website that I'm looking at here, there's no information on what happens with your insurance. As you say, it might be down to the individual insurers, but certainly what happens if you get pulled over by police then?
Exactly. I would imagine they would be aware of the situation as the PSNI are up here, the difficulties in obtaining it. It probably comes down to roadworthiness. But again, I think it's vital that each individual road user and car owner checks for themselves. But again, we go back to that point. There are attempts being made at the minute to try, and where people are under pressure time-wise with their insurance or with their tax, that they can avail of an emergency one, Holly. And I would stress to anyone who's listening who is in that position, contact your local MLA's office or contact the agency directly and try and avail of that emergency appointment. But back to what the original discussion said, we do need to see this urgent intervention from the Minister to hear how we're going to tackle this backlog, because, as I say, people's patience is worn out.
Yeah, and we've almost got to this situation now where people just accept it, because it has gone on for so long, for 4 years, as you say. It feels like people here just accept you're not going to get your MOT on time, so you'll inevitably be on a waiting list, and that's become normal. You sort of wonder, does the whole system need a bit of an overhaul? Why are we kind of sticking to the system that we have in Northern Ireland, which is obviously very different to what we have in England, Wales and Scotland?
Exactly. And that was part of the debate that was brought forward to the Minister last month, and that we look at other options. The reality is that elsewhere in the United Kingdom, waiting list times for MOTs are measured in a couple of hours or a couple of days.
You can just send a text to your local garage and get in the Absolutely. Same day and have it out by the end of the day again.
Yeah. And as you say, they've a completely different system. We have 15 centres here, Holly, that do MOTs. In England, there's 22,000.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very straightforward process. And I'm no expert. I am definitely know very little about cars. But, you know, you've got somebody who knows what they're doing, taking a look at your car to make sure it's safe. So at least every car that's got an MOT certificate in England and Wales and Scotland at the minute is safe back on the road. And here we've got thousands of cars that haven't been checked because they can't get an appointment.
Exactly. And that was one of the proposals that we made. We're not asking for a complete overhaul of the system. The system that we have works well when it works well.
That hasn't been for 4 years.
Yeah, but when you get your car there, it actually is a good process. It's getting that appointment. So we, as the Welsh Unionist Party, called for a hybrid model where big dealerships, for example, who sell thousands of cars a year and have the infrastructure in place, could almost prepare their own cars and MOT their own cars under an operational scheme that would take thousands out of the system for day-to-day users and end some of that backlog. So it wouldn't actually completely change the system, but would help alleviate the pressure. That sadly was ruled out completely by the minister. So again, we await to hear what this statement later in the month is. And I'm more than happy to come on your show after we've heard from the minister and to say what his plans are, because I think many people, including ourselves, are waiting eagerly to hear what those are and how impactful they're going to be.
John Stewart, UUP spokesperson for infrastructure. Thank you for your time on this morning.
No problem at all, Holly. Have a good day.
Well, a spokesperson from the department has said that the minister understands the frustrations of motorists over MOT testing waiting times and has asked officials to bring forward options for urgent consideration to ensure motorists have timely access to vehicle testing. The department is aware that a number of vehicle recovery firms had adjusted their policies to take account of the current MOT delays being experienced here and so continue to provide roadside assistance, and is not aware of any change of position on this. Let's speak to Alliance MLA Peter McReynolds, spokesperson for infrastructure. Good morning, Peter. Oh, good morning. Have we got you there, Peter?
Hello.
Look, there's a lot of confusion here because I think this roadside assistance is almost a symptom of a bigger picture, because even what the AA, for example, has been telling us, that they've had to change their stance on this in March. You know, they were telling us that there was an obligation legally that the only assistance they can provide to vehicles without a valid MOT is to recover them on a flatbed truck, and now they've been forced to change that. It's all a bit of a mess.
Yes, Holly, unfortunately it is a bit of a mess. And I mean, listening back to the callers that had phoned in earlier, I mean, I'm meeting someone next week who experienced the exact same issue. They were in Wales at the time and had broken down. AA called out to conduct their roadside repair and told them that they couldn't intervene because he didn't have a valid MOT. Now, I'm not sure what he did after that, but I mean, that was what he experienced in Wales.
And then, interestingly, just to pick up on that, is he allowed to drive in Wales without his MOT?
It is a legal requirement for everyone to have an MOT. Now, there are special circumstances involved where in which if you have one booked, that would be considered fine. And certainly,
but that's only within Northern Ireland?
Only within Northern Ireland, yes. And so we are an absolute outlier in terms of this, and I'm certainly listening back. I welcome that the AA have changed their approach. I raised in committee recently, in terms of speaking with the DVA, that the DVLA clamping people who aren't able to tax their car because of the backlog, and I'm pressing the DVLA to show the flexibility that the AA have now introduced in terms of what's happening here. Because, you know, I think it was numbers were referenced there in terms of how many MOTs were carried out last year. It was 1.15 million.
The numbers are staggering. And I raise your constituent there because obviously, I mean, according to the government website, that these arrangements in terms of having a valid MOT certificate, if you don't have one, that you're only exempt really from prosecution is if you are within this jurisdiction, i.e. Northern Ireland. People are confused here. I don't think people realise that. I don't even know what the situation is if you enter the Republic. We've got someone texting to say, with insurance companies, her daughter's insurance and MOT all ran out at the same time and they wouldn't insure her. So then it's down to every individual insurance company. And what's being done?
And engagement with your insurance company is important, because whatever the terms are that you have signed up and agreed to are the terms they're going to apply. So it's important and essential that you engage with them at all times to make sure that they're aware of here what your individual circumstances are. As MLAs, we're taking this issue incredibly seriously. The minister is acting as fast as he can to make sure that this backlog is addressed. You know, I referenced there 1.15 million MOTs have been carried out.
How fast? Is there a deadline in mind?
There's no deadline in mind, but we need to see movement at some point this year in terms of new centres being opened, etc. The centres are open 7 days a week at the minute to try to address this backlog. We need to also take into consideration that 50,000 missed appointments took place last year as well, so we'd ask the public to make sure that they stick to their appointments too.
Alliance MLA Peter McReynolds. Good morning, is the Nolan Show at 4 minutes past 10 with Holly Hamilton here. Just before we take more calls on the MOT story regarding the difficulty you're having getting appointments and the effect that that's having on other elements of your driving life, I just want to return to our top story on whether there should be a ban on smacking children. Now, we did ask the main political parties here what their position is on that potential ban, and we have now heard from Sinn Féin, who have told us we want children and families in the north to have the same rights and standards as those in the rest of Ireland. The defence for reasonable punishment was removed in the south as far back as 2015. We want a consistent approach across the island. Lots of calls coming in on that, and also your situation with the MOT certificates and the difficulties that you're facing. We were covering this morning people who have roadside assistance. They've been paying their fees as normal, but they were unable to get it when they broke down because they didn't have their MOT. We also heard people getting in touch. They're having problems with their insurance, other people getting clamped. It's also worth mentioning another element of this. When we contacted the Minister for Infrastructure, John O'Dowd, and he responded with these figures that 1.1 million vehicle tests have been carried out in each of the last 2 years, the highest numbers ever recorded. He goes on to say that disappointingly, in the region of 50,000 customers failed to attend a booked appointment in each of the last 2 years. And we've just had a text from someone, can't confirm this obviously, says that they have a friend who works in a test centre, 362 appointments missed in the last month in one test centre alone, 6 missed yesterday, which surely is part of the problem. John's got in touch. He says a garage in Wales would have done an MOT there and then. A lot of people going over to Scotland to get an MOT done. And we do have that issue, just according to the government website, that that you do need an MOT certificate if you are travelling outside of Northern Ireland, that there will not be a police exemption. But we're just going to be look into that and get confirmation of that for you. Let's speak to Robert. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Holly. Holly, you're on, people don't talking about getting clamped. How do you eliminate that? Is you set up a direct debit for your road tax, regardless why you're MOT'd or not, to still take that direct debit out every month. Mm-hmm. And secondly, if you've applied for an MOT, and thirdly, if you've put it in a garage and the garage says it's fit for MOT and he gives you a receipt verifying that there, you're legally allowed to be on the road. And on them circumstances, the AA then should be able to come out if you did unfortunately break down and for some reason.
Some good tips there, Robert. Yeah, it's certainly the direct debit thing. If you're in a position to set up a direct debit, then it avoids any mess. However, I've been informed that there's a limit on that. I mean, I don't know the details on that, but something just to be careful of. Robert, thank you for your call. Thomas in Antrim, good morning.
Good morning, Holly. During the boycott when the MLAs weren't sitting, I reached out to my local MLA because my wife needed her MOT for the 8th of January. So I started trying. I knew that it was like a 6 month delay. And I started in August trying to get an MOT. But the MOT, you can only book it 3 months in advance. But whenever you could try to book it, the dates are 4 and 5 and 6 months in advance. So my MLA wrote to the Department of Infrastructure. And he got a response on my behalf. He didn't send it to me. I had to go and ask him for it. But it was like a 2-page essay that said that the website cannot be changed without the MLAs debating it in the Assembly.
It's also complicated, isn't it? It is really complicated. And look, Thomas, we've got people getting in touch, including Alan, who's on the line, saying that they're going elsewhere to get their MOT. Tell me about that, Alan.
Yeah, I'm due to go away in July, and on Saturday I decided to flip a better book my MOT. So it went on, it's due on the 9th of May, went on, and in September was the nearest date. to the nearest MOT centre, check all around, still September. So then about 15 minutes later, I'm due to go to England in July. So about 15 minutes later, I decided then I'll go back on again. And within an hour, I had an MOT. There must have been a cancellation come through. Now, if you go to England, I have to drive down to England in July. Uh-huh. And if you go to England in July, their jurisdiction, you are not covered. I can tell you that now because I inquired
into it. You're definitely not. They're trying to get confirmation. Definitely not covered.
You're definitely not. I inquired into it and you're only covered in Northern Ireland. And you must notify your insurance and have an MOT booked.
Which I'm sure is causing problems for a lot of people. Alan, thank you very much for your call. Thanks for bringing that to our attention. Again, we'll explore a little more into that. It is just approaching 10 minutes past 10. Thank you so much for all your calls and texts this morning. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this next story. Is a university degree really worth it? That's the question comedian Jeff Norcott has been asking in his new BBC documentary. In this film, he's a tough decision to make. Start a university fund for his son to follow in his footsteps, or buy himself a new car.
I'm Jeff Norcott, stand-up comedian.
I'm feeling good.
An author.
Welcome to Question Time.
And political commentator.
And I think it's time that politicians start being honest.
And when I went to uni, it was a time to explore choices, you know, make mistakes, have fun.
Look how much fun it was. And it was free.
And now, proud dad myself, I've started thinking about what uni might be like for Jeff Jr. So I should be putting away a bit of money now so that Jeff Jr. can follow in my footsteps. So I'm going to hit the road to find out where my money's best spent and start doing some research. And at the end, I'll decide, do I start a university fund for Jeff Jr. or does daddy get a new motor?
What a choice. Well, we did hear from Jeff recently on The Nolan Show. Let's have a listen to this.
The experience in itself has value. No one, and the film itself is not knocking that. But I think what the difference between sort of us, Stephen, is our generation, is that the cost has ballooned exponentially to the point where you now have to scrutinise every element of it much more harshly. The tuition fees went up quite a while ago and have stayed at $9,000. But meanwhile, rents have gone up. The maintenance loans that students can take haven't gone up in line with inflation. So it's a different deal. And I've got to say, going around, you know, universities and speaking to students, there's a sort of demoralised feel out there. You know, in an ideal world, of course, follow your passion, you know, study the history of art and, you know, golf course management or whatever it is that floats your boat. But, you know, as far as university just being a degree which gets you in the door for certain jobs, it's not even clear that that's the case anymore either. You know, in the early 60s, 4% of people went to university and got degrees. Now it's 40%, right? So we all know that scarcity and value are connected in some ways, right? We all know why diamonds cost more than pebbles. Now, it might be that there's an argument that having a highly educated population is preferable for all societies, but it's naturally to be a little bit sceptical about that. It did feel like university and a degree used to be a way of getting a great job. Now it feels like it's a way of getting any job, you know, or just a job, just to get your foot in the door. So hence why the film itself then goes on to look at things like apprenticeships and plumbing.
So, is a university degree worth it? Or is getting yourself out there into a vocation or the world of business better off for some in the long run? Well, I've been chatting to 20-year-old student Dermot Hamill and recruitment specialist Max Mackin and getting their reaction.
I think it will be worth it in the long run. I mean, I'd like to earn quite a lot of money after I graduate if I can. And I think this is probably the only way I'm going to do that at this stage. I think so.
Do you think then that given the way things are, do you think that you need a degree to be financially successful if that's your goal?
Yes, more than likely. I mean, if I perhaps went and did a trade, I could, you know, probably earn a lot of money. But I am not cut out for outdoor work. It's just the way I am. I'm 5'7". I'm never going to work well. But I think, really and truly, with the way the professional world is going nowadays, there's no kind of, there's very little routes in to earn, you know, a well-paying job without a degree. At this stage, you know, professionals are now starting to have to look at doing masters just to get a well-paid job. So it's really not, it's not getting better. The whole thing's getting worse.
Yeah, it's interesting, Max, listening to that. What do you make of that? The idea that not only do some people feel that they need a degree to be financially successful, but have to stay in education even longer now to get a master's.
It's interesting listening to what Dermot was saying, because like, you definitely don't need a degree to earn a really good living or earn a lot of money. There's numerous other things you can go into to do it. However, you know, answering the question, I think the narrative from the mid-90s has been to push people into higher education. So like when I was like Dermot's age, only maybe 20% of the people I knew went to university. Everyone else just got a job and got onto the career ladder. And if you did go to university at some stage, that person would be my boss later on down the line, because, you know, the more intelligent, more driven people went to university. But it seems now a lot more widespread that people feel that you need to go to university. Some probably want to go and have the university experience, because at the end of the graduation, we have seen in recruitment that people take up jobs and go into careers that are non-degree necessary. You know, they'll take a job that's not brilliantly paid, it's reasonably paid, but it doesn't warrant you having a degree. And we've noticed people who have come in to do a degree and halfway through it, they say that, like, you know, when Dermot just paused there about, is it a good degree to do law? People realize it's really, really hard. And the law itself, to be a solicitor, is quite a hard job, a lot of research. You're not in court saying, Your Honour, my defendant is innocent. That doesn't really happen, like you see on TV. It's quite a hard job and a well-paid job. However, you know, electricians, roofers, builders, plumbers, painters, if you try and get someone in those fields now at the minute, it's almost impossible, because they're so busy, they're so in demand, and they make so much money. So there's a whole field that people can move into to either equal or better their earnings than just degree-educated jobs.
It's interesting too, because particularly with law, Dermot, you don't necessarily, and a lot of people I know who studied law didn't actually end up being lawyers.
Yeah, I mean, whenever I did a first year politics degree last year at Queen's, and I ended up dropping out of it because I wasn't enjoying it. But whenever I kind of told my friends that study or had graduated from law that I was going to do law, they all told me not to do law.
Really? Why?
I think it was just, it is possibly one of the hardest degrees out there, and it is genuinely incredibly depressing at more or less every juncture, and I'm only first year.
But you're definitely not selling it to me now, Dermot.
I wouldn't leave the journalism gig for it.
There are many reasons I won't be doing that. I mean, so if you were speaking to a younger version of yourself, would you still do what you're doing now? Would you ever have considered, you know, an apprenticeship or getting a job straight out of school?
Well, I considered not doing my A-levels and simply going and becoming a bricklayer, because it's what my father does. Mm-hmm. But I worked a summer with him and realised that working at height, working outside and working generally with my hands was not for me. It's definitely not cut out for that. I mean, in terms of getting a job straight after my A-levels, there just isn't very many options. I mean, I had looked at some possible, you know, journalism apprenticeships and things, but there were very few and far between. Like, there is talks about all of these higher level and these new apprenticeship opportunities that pop up. But really and truly, if anyone wants a professional qualification or professional job, the options aren't particularly widespread.
It's funny because, Dermot, you're 20 years old, okay? And when I was at school, there was definitely a push that people were expected to at least attempt to go to university, whether or not they were academic. It was that there was a lot of pressure that you should be going to university, and it almost didn't matter what degree. I feel like the perception of that is changing, but even hearing Dermot say, you know, at 20 years old, you know, Max, he didn't feel like there were many options other than going to university. Was that, or, you know, do the job that his dad did?
Well, when I was, you know, that young, many, many years ago, I had to go to London to get a job. There was just no employment opportunities here whatsoever. So as a 20-year-old looking sort of at the world and trying to sort of make your mark, it is difficult. You know, what do you do and where do you go? Like sort of Dermot mentioned journalism, but the invention of social media is kind of almost like sort of ruined that as an industry for a lot of people, because it used to be a very high-paid sort of role that people could get into it. Whereas now, sort of, you know, anyone with a podcast is a journalist. So it's reduced this sort of like earning potential for that there and the drive for it. But there's loads of jobs. There's loads of jobs around. What people have to understand is that there's no job you walk into. Did you get £40,000 in your first year? You get a company car. You get 40 days a year holiday, and you can work from home or not work from home whenever you want. Anybody who wants to get on the financial ladder to success when they're older needs to understand you got to put a wee bit of effort in. And it was just interesting listening to Dermot saying, like, you know, it is a hard degree. But usually the harder degrees are the most rewarding degrees. That if you do go into work, you know, an employer will look at that and sort of say, well, it shows you've got resilience, it shows you've got determination, it shows you've got a bit of staying power, it shows you're intelligent, it shows you can follow a process. So all these things are good and look good for future employers when they look at sort of the type of degree you have and the type of mark you got when you've done the degree. However, in saying that, you know, I was speaking to a guy the other day who was a roofer. And he's got a really nice big house. He drives a lovely car. They have holidays and stuff. And he says he just cannot get staff. He says the minute sort of people come in and after 6 weeks ago, this is too hard. A bit like sort of what Dermot was saying about working for his dad. It's not for him. But it's quite a rewarding job and it's quite a rewarding career. You know, most people who start off through an apprenticeship end up running their own business, albeit a small business, but quite a profitable business. And a business where you're always kind of sort of like needed and you know, you can work your own hours or do what you want. And a lot of people, a lot of young people coming through don't really understand the long-term potential these types of roles offer them.
And what we've focused a lot on the financial aspect of this, the financial reward. And I remember it's interesting that you mentioned journalism, because even whenever I had aspired to be a journalist when I was very young, my mum was a journalist and she said, don't go into journalism. There's no money in it. You know? Because that was the priority even then, you know. Whereas for me, I kind of, you know, was young and silly and foolish and wanted to follow my dream. But for you, Dermot, I mean, what was the dream for you? What did you want to do?
Whenever I first went to uni, it was to study international relations. At least 10% of that was because I didn't really know what international relations was.
studying it's one way to find out.
By the time I had spent £4,000, I realised I had no interest in international relations. But I think, I mean, to an extent, most of what I, whenever I kind of said I was going to uni, it was about getting a kind of nice job where I get to wear a suit all the time and possibly continue my work in politics and political commentary. But really, by the end, like to an extent, I didn't really go to university for a passion project or out of an interest. And I don't wait, to be honest, other than the very select group of friends I have that are studying things like theatrical arts and, you know, things like that. I don't really know many people that are at university doing passion projects. Because it's at £4,000 a year, which will eventually rise when Sunak gets his way, plus, you know, thousands on rent to live in usually Belfast in the Holy Lands, which is essentially a slum.
It's outrageous accusations here.
It's quite a lot of money to spend on kind of to do something.
Well, this is the issue, isn't it? Because no matter what, that seems to be the way the narrative has gone. I don't know, Max, if you've seen this with people that you've been speaking to, that they do feel they have to kind of stay in the system. And it's a very expensive way of doing it, really, when you think about it. The financial cost of this, just to get a degree, just because you're not quite sure what you want to do, maybe has to be another way.
If Holly sort of, if we can sort of put, like, I know for a fact that I'm older than you, but when you're sort of a young person looking out in life and looking forward, it is full of sort of like dreams and aspirations, and you do want to push forward and you do want to achieve these goals. And the narrative of late, for the last 20 years anyway, has been you do need to go to university, you do need a good degree, you do need to do this. And there is no two degrees that people do. I mean, you're 100% correct that they'll come out of university and think, I wish I hadn't done that degree. And they'll get a job or employment somewhere where their degree's not really used, or the information they learned during the degree is not really necessary. But it's put them on the path to somewhere else. I just think sort of, you know, if I was to give anybody advice, just sort of is speak to like as many older people as possible and ask them their stories, because usually what happens is history just repeats itself. And what I would sort of say is, if you're trying to be moving on, you probably, without trying to sound patronizing, because you've not experienced, you've not really found out, one, what you're good at, two, what you enjoy, three, what sort of gets you to bed in the morning, sort of, you know, like sort of Dermot mentioned getting a suit on and looking smart. And I suppose what he means by that is getting a job that means that he adds value, that he actually sort of walks in and he has, you know, a purpose, and then what he does makes a difference. All those things are really good things. But there's so many different aspects. There's so many different types of industries. Like Like recently, there's been a huge surge now in engineering. Kids now coming through all want to do engineering. And I can only relay that to, really, is because of people like Elon Musk. It's made it sexy again.
Made it cool, people, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people a few years ago, it just wasn't something you can do. But you're creating something, you're inventing something, you're making something with your hands, it's going to last. And you can earn a lot of money doing it. But also as well, it's a very creative role too. So it kind of ticks the boxes. But it's only in the last like 10 years or so engineering's become cool again.
And a lot of that comes down to what young people are being told in schools. So I suppose, Dermot, when you were at school, did it feel to you, like I was saying earlier, that you had to do a degree? Did anyone come in and talk to you about apprenticeships or anything like that?
I mean, we did careers and employability and that kind of thing for 2 years at A-level, and we did it in GCSE years
as well. What does that involve these days?
Well, I mean, in our upper six, in 7th years, we called it. It was largely kind of, okay, who wants to go down the university route? And if, like, I will preface this with, I went to a fairly well performing grammar school, and you know, it was largely full of. By the time you got to your A level, most people were focused on going to university. But I can remember in my careers class of, I'm going to take a stab at, say, 25 people. I whenever we were asked who's going to apply for uni, I think everyone bar two put their hands up. One of the guys was emigrating, and I think the other guy just had no interest. And I think he had done A-levels to kind of make his mum happy, but he wasn't pursuing academia any further. So, but I mean, we were told about things like higher-level apprenticeships and told that these are all options. But if, you know, 23 people out of 25 in the class are all looking to just get on and apply for their UCAS and do all of that and get their personal statement written in the midst of also mock exams and then exams, you're not going to go exploring about higher level apprenticeships, because I hate to say it, like, in that time, you don't have time. You're too busy, you know, focusing on the main option, the big one that's pushed and rammed down your throat. And then, you know, you can say, oh, I'm going to Queen's, or I'm going to Trinity or Ulster or wherever.
Yeah. So if you were speaking to Jeff Norcott, would you be advising him to keep saving for his son's university degree or go buy himself a car?
I'd probably tell him to keep saving, because as much as a new car is lovely, if his son decides that he does want to go to university, it is not cheap.
It's not cheap,
and it is not getting any cheaper.
And Max, what car would you advise him to buy?
Something that has a very, very long, long lifespan. Something that he's going to have a resale value. But just on the basis of what Dermot was saying there, you know, it just seems there's a lot of peer pressure on younger people these days, especially in the school thing, to be doing what the Joneses do or doing what the Smiths do. And some of that there, I think, just falls by the way. So, you know, in a very final note, I have a nephew, Desmond, who's an electrician. And like, he annoys me. Like, he changes his car every 2 years.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? He's just, his phone rings.
We hear that story a lot, yeah.
Yeah, his phone rings like 20, 25 times a day at people. And he's booked.
I'm probably one of them.
Work, and he'd be like, well, I can sort you in. Like, this is, you know, I can do you in June, or I can do you maybe the start of July. Like, he's got so much work lined up and thing. So I think, sort of, anyone is listening, don't just assume that because the Joneses are doing what the Joneses are doing, you have to follow suit.
It's good advice. Just do your own thing. Great to speak to you both. Thanks very much to Max Mackin and Dermot Hamill. Good luck with the degree, Dermot.
Thank you.
All right. Speak to you
again.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you. And if you want to find out if Jeff Norcott got a car or started a university fund for his son, you can find the documentary on the BBC iPlayer. It's called Is University Really Worth It? Getting lots of texts still about the situation with MOT appointments. Dermot says, my MOT isn't until the 6th of September. I just went onto the website and booked it already for the 5th of September. 5 months in advance he's managed to get in there. Michael in Yatnards is outside a test centre. Hang on a second. We've got Johnny who's outside a test centre right now. Johnny.
Hello.
Johnny, you're outside a test centre. How are you feeling, first of all? I'm always a bit nervous beforehand.
No, I'm feeling great because the fellow's just delivered my car. It's done and all, so...
Oh, did you pass?
Yeah, I did indeed.
It's a good day for Johnny. How was your process then, getting an appointment?
It was actually very helpful, I have to say. I was... like a lot of people, my tax was up at the end of this month, April, and when I got my notification that my card was due, I immediately applied for the test, being aware that there's a bit of a backlog.
Uh-huh.
The earliest I could get was mid-June, and so they told me to keep ringing back and trying, and I could get it a wee bit earlier, but not early enough to come inside my tax, my car tax window,
yeah.
So I phoned just a week before last there, and a very helpful fella called Brian. The number rang was it's on the back of the notification sheet that they give you. It's it might be helpful, 0300 200 7862. Very helpful fella called Brian told me that if I leave it for and phone on Wednesday, which was the 18th, I believe, that comes inside a 10-day window.
Johnny, I'll have to leave it there because we're running out of time, but I think that in itself is very helpful. What did you say? 0800 200 7862 and ask for Brian. Poor Brian's going to be getting a lot of calls today, Johnny, because of you. Thanks very much for your call. Thanks for all your texts today. We'll be back tomorrow. Friday it is at 9 o'clock. See you then.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.